You are listening to The Pulse. And it is, and I'm joined today by Becky, Stefan, Lewis, and Emma, and I am Charlie. And we have loads of interesting stories for you today. If you would like to get in touch, you can with www.urine1350.net or on Facebook or Twitter at urine1350. But first, we have a story from Stefan about pollution.
Thank you. The Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, has announced plans to more than double funding to clean up the air of the city. Under the plan, air quality measures will receive £875 million over the next 5 years, up from the £425 million that Boris Johnson committed to. London is one of a number of UK cities breaching EU nitrogen dioxide standards, which is a toxic gas caused by diesel vehicles. As you might expect, London is the worst out of the bunch, with air pollution linked to nearly 9,500 premature deaths each year. If approved, the largest proportion of the money, £312 million, will be spent on improving transport for London's bus fleet, with an extra £65 million to be used to encourage taxi drivers to switch to new eco-friendly cabs. Local neighbourhood schemes will receive an additional £14 million to tackle some hotspots outside the city centre, and I assume the rest will be used on similarly excellent proposals. There are other plans in conjunction, notably the introduction of an ultra-low emission zone a year earlier than planned, with twice the area. And generally, this is an example of an increase in environmental policy by the government. I think these are excellent steps forward, especially considering that a month ago we were reporting about the High Court ruling against the government's failure to tackle illegal air pollution. So maybe this is a sign of more positive things to come, but there's been quite a bit of concern, but maybe they could have gone further. And I wanted to know what you guys thought. Do you think they should go further than this?
I think it's any steps that they make are always good steps. Any recognition that there is an issue and making steps to tackle it is good, because if they weren't doing anything, then that's obviously not quite so good. In terms of whether it's enough, I mean, we can question whether it's enough based on the fact we've got, I think it's Paris and Rome, Athens and somewhere else that's not London, recently have agreed together that they want to ban all diesel cars' engines. Is that not true?
Yes, it is. And you completely stole what I was just going to say.
I'm so sorry.
Paris, Madrid, Athens and Mexico City, the mayors of those cities have all pledged to ban diesel vehicles from their cities by 2025, and that was actually one of the suggestions critics had made towards Sadiq Khan.
So it's like, it's good that they've made steps, and obviously Sadiq Khan's in a position where he knows what is possible now and what isn't possible now in terms of actually having the means to be able to do it, but we know that it's also possible to go further, and I hope that because London has passed these measures to try and tackle environmental problems and air quality, now that they don't become complacent and they try to develop their initiatives for the future.
I mean, I think it's just an example of increase in steps in eventually full environmental compliance or whatever. I'm slightly concerned about the fact that this is, as I mentioned, due to EU regulations, and I'm a little bit concerned as to what the effect of us leaving the European Union will have on our compliance, whether we will still focus on curtailing environmental damage or whether we will actually shift away from that perspective. But it definitely seems that public perception is towards helping the environment, which is, I guess, kind of a good thing that we elected Sadiq Khan in the end then.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Sadiq Khan, actually. But I do think that the fact that London have brought out these measures should encourage other cities in the UK to follow suit. I don't understand why the other mayors haven't said, you know, I know London's the capital city, obviously, but places like Manchester, which is the northern powerhouse, they should have come out with the same policies or similar policies to reduce it nationwide rather than just in the capital. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I think I was quite surprised by the fact that there was 9,500 people who had premature deaths linked to air pollution. And that was just in London. So if we extrapolate that to the entire UK, And I think that number's, I don't actually have the statistic on me, but I would be quite worried to see what that is. And I think, as you say, anything should be done. I mean, yes, London's the biggest one by far, much bigger than any other city. So it's good that we're having the progress here. Maybe that in turn will encourage other cities to follow its example.
Yeah, you don't think about air pollution being one of, you know, a big killer like that. Especially in this country.
Yeah.
You think of it maybe in China, but not in the UK. And it's quite surprising for me, that statistic. And it makes me feel like we should tackle it more. But it was an interesting point how you brought up the Brexit, how it may affect it. I mean, we don't have to abide by EU regulations anymore. And do you actually think that politicians may slack on areas such as that?
Well, to link that to the other big topic of 2016,
Link it.
Again, it's Donald Trump.
Oh.
But he's got his anti-environmental policies as well. And I've seen a lot of people worried about what effect he might actually have. But the counter argument to that is that public perception is so in favour of the environment. And we've, throughout the last however many years, we've had it drummed into our heads so much that the environment is something we need to save and that there are various things we should do to fix it. And it's not just about politicians making the decisions anymore. Companies are doing that on their own. We're doing it on our own. And together, we will work of our own volition. And we don't need to actually have our policies dictated by politicians anymore, especially in regard to the environment. So I'd hope that even if we do tear away from regulations, either we'll put our own regulations up in place, which would be excellent, or even if we don't, companies and the like will just switch to eco-friendly alternatives.
Yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, there was a statistic actually that was released, I think, a couple of days ago that by, I think it was it 2020, that renewable energy would actually be cheaper as well. Cheaper than nuclear, unless, you know, more oil is found, which would cause it to go back again.
Upset, yeah.
So hopefully by, I think, was it 2020 or 20? It was, I think it might have been a bit later, 2030 maybe, renewable energy should be cheaper. So companies should be looking, you know, to go to, down that route if it's going to be cheaper in the future anyway and help the environment. I think if I was a CEO of a company right now, I would be looking at that kind of thing, especially if the mayor, it's nice to see that politicians like the Mayor of London are encouraging that as well.
I mean, it's quite actually good because you mentioned companies who are doing it of their own accord and all that,
mm-hmm.
And they're doing it off their own backs, really. But there are companies who dedicate their entire kind of business plan towards improving the environment. So a lot of these renewable energy companies do actually have the aim purely to improve the environment. And to have one, possibly two good example, it's Elon Musk, or have you pronounced his name, and Tesla and SolarCity and all that. They recently released supposedly super cheap roofing tiles, which actually were solar powered. And he's stated his entire aim is to improve the world for everyone's benefit. And I think if we get more people like him who actually have a position like that and have the ability to improve the world and improve the quality of life for everyone involved, I think that's fantastic. And I think he's probably the first, or maybe not first, but definitely a very clear example of this new wave of like proactive business in helping the environment. I can only hope that will increase.
Well, fingers crossed, I think. I think that's all we've got time for on that story. If you want to get involved, you can. You can give us a little text at www.urn1350.net, or you can give us a tweet or a Facebook message at urn1350. But we've got kind of a Christmas themed pulse today. We are going to be playing Christmas songs in between our stories. And to kick it all off, we've got Do They Know It's Christmas by Band-Aid.
It's Christmas time, there's no need to be afraid. At Christmas time, we let in light and we banish shade. And in our world of plenty, we can spread a smile of joy. Throw your arms around the world at Christmas time.
Hi, my name's Meg Ashdown, and I was your news editor for 2015 to 2016. I am the legend who interviewed Jeremy Corbyn and Eddie Izzard, and this is The Pulse, the news that matters to you.
We just had a story from Stefan there about pollution, and now we've got a story from me about surrogacy. A woman has given birth to her own grandchild by having a surrogate baby for her daughter. Julie Bradford, who's 45, had baby Jack for her daughter Jessica Jenkins, whose cancer left her infertile. She had her eggs frozen at Cardiff's University Hospital aged 21 before her treatment for cervical cancer. Jack, her son, was born last Friday. Jessica describes her mother as the most brave and amazing woman in the world. Her mother Julie said that it had been an honour to carry her daughter's child. In 2014, surrogate births hit a record high, and in Britain surrogacy is only legal if done for altruistic reasons, for example as a favour to a friend or a relative. So guys, my question to you is, do you think surrogacy like this case causes moral issues for the child, for example growing up knowing that, well, it depends if they tell the child obviously, but knowing that your birth mother was actually your grandma?
Yeah, but what's the alternative?
Well, true. Yeah.
Do you think
it's right for the mother to have done it, or?
I guess there would be the option of having someone else be the surrogate parent, but at the end of the day, I feel like this is just, you know, it's someone you trust. It's someone who's got the same genes with you. It's possibly as close to having your actual mother give birth to you as possible. And I think in this case, yes, it was a little bit confusing to get my head around exactly the relationship which was going on. And I feel like classically you might have a lot of moral issues, as you mentioned, or traditionally people might have been a little bit upset over it. But I think this is just an example of how modern science can prevail against unfortunate natural issues. And I think it's an excellent turn of events, really. There would have been, it's given the daughter the chance to actually have a child where she wouldn't have been able to normally. It's kept within the family, so there's no other issue about that. And I think it's excellent, really. I think it's a real triumph for science.
I have to say I'm kind of slightly torn with this. Part of me does completely agree with Stefan that it's better to keep it into the family, you know, similar genes and everything that you've just mentioned. But on the other hand, I do think in a way it makes it slightly more confusing for the child, like some slightly blurred boundaries maybe. I'm not sure. Although it's harder and there's a lot of problems that would come with this option, maybe sometimes for the child it's better if the surrogate's someone outside of the family. I know then you do have the trust problem, but I can't help but think it would be just a little bit confusing for the child to grow up knowing that its grandmother was the one who gave birth.
Do you think adoption would have been a better idea then? Seeing as, you know, there's a lot of children out there who do need to be adopted.
Well, yeah, I think that's obviously another perfectly, you know, viable option that would be exceptionally rewarding. I suppose that it just depends on the case. For one family, that would be right. But, you know, for this woman, Jessica, I think her name was, maybe she wanted that biological connection.
Bond,
yeah. So I think it just depends. But I was just slightly torn. I think that would be quite a confusing dynamic for the child, I'd say.
Go on.
I think it would only be... I think it's confusing from our end because we're not involved in the relationship. We're looking at it from an objective, an outsider's point of view. I think if the child grows up knowing that fact from birth... I mean, I can't be sure because I have no idea how the child's going to be able to react to the news.
Well, it's only a week old at the moment.
Exactly. So it hasn't had a lot of time to grapple with the specifics of the situation. But in terms of, I think there's a possibility that they could see that as a totally natural thing that happened. I think from an outsider's point of perspective, it might seem unnatural, but I think at the end of the day it's between the mother, the surrogate mother, and the child. And I think what the grandmother has done, what the surrogate mother has done, I think is amazing. I think it's anybody that offers themselves as a surrogate mother is so selfless because it's basically going through a whole pregnancy for another person's child. I think it's an amazing thing for somebody to even offer to do, let alone to actually go through. So I think it's a lovely story.
It's an incredible thing to sacrifice your body for. I think you're correct. Do you think there should be a limit in terms of procreation, though, for people who are infertile? Do you think science should stop at a certain point?
No.
I
think the right to having a child is fundamentally absolute, and I don't think you can mm-hmm. anyone can take that away, really. Just because you're infertile, then there's no reason why you should be... I don't understand any argument why you should be stopped. Is that not...
I mean, after a few IVFs, some doctors would encourage you to go towards adoption because, you know, there is a limit to how many times you can try and it not be successful. For couples like that, do you think that they should be allowed to just carry on trying for the same method, or do you think they should be pushed towards adoption?
I think it's their body. Yeah. I think they possibly should be encouraged. Given the full course of facts, taught exactly, given the necessary education to know exactly what is the issue here, both health-wise and maybe even morally or even psychologically as a child grows up. But definitely, I feel like ultimately it has to be someone's choice. I don't think you can take this choice away from someone. Yes, you can encourage them or influence them into different ways, but I think, I mean, I'm not, I yeah, I think this is pretty important, right, this one. And I think, like, if you say, yeah, doctors can stop you having a child, then how do you qualify that? When do they do that? How do you put limits on, how would you make
that workable?
But
then is that doctor stopping you from having a child or your body?
Well, if it's your body, then either way, you can't manage it. But at the end of the day, and of course, you, that's not really your choice, I guess. But at the same time, that's not another person kind of forcing you to stop. I feel like that forcing element is quite reprehensible, maybe. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
I mean, this topic's quite interesting for me because I have a relative right now going through IVF and it's failed twice for them. So I do know that they're getting to this point now where they want to keep trying, but the doctors are saying, you know, we don't think it's going to work. We think you should go towards adoption. And it's causing them quite a moral issue because their heart says, carry on going. We want a child of our own biological being, but we also want a child that much that we'd rather have a child than not have a child. If you get my gist. So it's quite a moral dilemma to go through. And I feel like surrogacy, you know, is an option, but I feel like surrogacy also causes moral issues in terms of the surrogate having to give away a baby. I mean, I don't personally think I could do surrogacy. I think it's a very brave thing for somebody to do. I think it's easier if you are the grandmother, because at least then you get to see the child. I feel like if it's a friend, I would really struggle, because you're not necessarily going to have the same contact with the child as you would expect to have. What do you think, girls? Would you be able to, do you think?
I don't think I could. I think, as you've just said, it's an exceptionally brave thing to do. But no, I don't think I could do it and then hand the baby away and never see it again. I think I'd get too emotionally involved and attached. Which then, I guess, no, this sort of goes against what I said before, but then maybe, I suppose, some of the arguments you were saying before, that for going back to this story with the grandmother, maybe then it is better that it was her and not a stranger carrying the child, because then at least she can see the baby grow up. So, but no, either way, I still think it's something I'd struggle with quite a lot.
No, I've got to say, I think it is an absolutely lovely story, and we've got to commend the grandmother for doing that for her daughter. I think that's all we've got to say on that story. If you want to give us a little text in, you can at www.urn1350.net. But now we've got a bit of Bublé, and it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas everywhere you go. Take a look at the 5 and 10. It's glistening once again with candy canes and silver lanes that glow. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. Toys in every store, but the prettiest sight to see is the holly that will be on your own front door. A pair of hop-along boots and a pistol that shoots is the wish of Barney and Ben. Dolls that'll talk and we'll go for a walk is the hope of Janice and Jen. And Mom and Dad can hardly wait for school to start again. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas everywhere you go. There's a tree in the Grand Hotel, one in the park as well. It's the sturdy kind that doesn't mind the snow. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. Soon the bells will start, and the thing that'll make them ring is the carol that you sing right within your heart. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. Toys in every store, but the prettiest sight to see is the holly that will be on your own front door. Sure, it's Christmas once a more.
This is URN The Pulse.
That was a beautiful Michael Bublé there. We've just had a story on surrogacy from me. If you'd like to get in touch with any of our stories, you can on Twitter at URN1350. But now we've got a story from Lewis on whether parents should be graded at schools.
Indeed, I've got an article here from the Huffington Post. They've reported that there's a school in Nottinghamshire that is giving their parents to their pupils. They're giving the parents' grades as to their levels of support to their child in this primary school. It's at Greasley Bow Vale Primary School in Nottinghamshire, and they're giving marks from A, which is actively involved, down to D, which is no support at all. This has caught the social network community by storm. Parents have been debating whether schools should give parents grades based on the support that they give for their child in terms of attendance for parents' evenings and school plays, etc. But the head teacher of the primary school, Donna Chambers, told the Daily Mail that it's been really quite well received. Elsewhere, it's also been debated in the local newspaper in Plymouth, the Plymouth Herald, and in the poll online there, they found that 56% were in favour of the grading scheme at the school. However, on the Facebook page, there were some other slightly less agree in favour comments. One, for example, was, I think some school teachers these days put too much ridiculous amounts of pressure on parents. Another has said, what if a parent has learning difficulties themselves or is dyslexic? Some parents feel bad enough that they can't help their children. The editor said that the poll was a small sample size, so it can't be taken too seriously, but it is an interesting snapshot of what public opinion is on this matter, a highly divisive and controversial subject. He also said that on Facebook, men were more approving of the scheme than females, so potentially an interesting thing to analyse there. For you guys, I mean, do you think this is a good idea, especially when parents have such busy schedules themselves, or can have such busy schedules nowadays? Is it fair to rate them on their attendance at a school play?
I mean, I love the idea as not a parent, but if I was a parent, I'd be furious. Because my mum's been a teacher for years, and, you know, some of the stories she's told me about parents not coming to things and, you know, just not listening to her advice on, you know, the child's capabilities and things like that. I feel completely like they should be graded almost. But as a parent, I would be furious if the school decided to give me a D for parenthood. I just wouldn't take it, especially if it's not, you know, it's nothing legal binding or anything, is it? It's just somebody telling me I'm not a very good parent, and I don't think many parents would take that very lightly.
I think it's ridiculous to grade a parent on their attendance at a school play, because, I mean, extenuating circumstances have to be taken into account. I mean, my mum had a part-time job, so she was present all those things, but my dad had full-time, and therefore he couldn't help me as much. He couldn't turn up to the parents' evenings. So I think this needs to be taken into account before we start giving parents a D for not helping their child.
Does it even matter if they get a D? I don't really understand what the consequences of this are. I mean,
well, it's nothing, but it'd anger you. If I went there and you had a child and I said, "You're a bad dad," you'd look at me and go, "No, excuse me."
Well,
you'd be offended.
If I didn't turn up to these things, maybe I didn't care. Maybe I wouldn't care about whether I got graded or not. I feel like this is only going to anger people who do care, and those people are going to be there already. They're already going to be supporting their child.
True.
And at the end of the day, I mean, what does it matter if a parent's getting shamed into going to these events? I don't think that's very healthy either. That kind of creates more conflict rather than less. Yes, absolutely we should have more parent involvement in schools. I mean, I don't actually know if we don't have that much. I mean, actually, you just said that we don't. But I feel like this isn't really something which is going to cause that much controversy. And if it's just one school doing it, then I don't really see that much of an issue in it. Personally, I don't think I'd be too bothered. I think I wouldn't be furious. I actually think it probably would have the right effect on me by making me...
Do you think?
Yeah, no, because I like...
What, you'd feel like a naughty school child you'd have to go to?
I feel like naughty school child all the time.
I just... Go on, sorry.
I have to say, I don't really like the idea. I think for me, it's almost like the teachers treating the parents as some more of the children who... their teaching. I think, you know, a teacher has the right to encourage parents to get involved in their children's school life and come to all the nativity plays and activities and listen to their child read and everything. But I don't really think the teacher, whether it's a big deal or not, like Stefan was just saying, I don't really think the teacher has a right to give a grade to the parent. I mean, at the end of the day, they're all just adults and all equals. And yeah, for me, it just seems a bit like the teachers treating the parents like more children.
I mean, for me, it just doesn't seem very constructive. It's just like, it doesn't seem to be, I mean, they might well have an in-depth discussion about the level of support they give their child afterwards. But to just say, right, here's a D because you didn't go to X event or Y event, it seems a very combative way of ramming this issue home. It doesn't seem like it's... any sort of adult conversation between the two. It seems quite two-dimensional because unless they are taking into account all of the different commitments and jobs that the parents might have, it doesn't seem to be resolving anything apart from shaming certain parents that legitimately can't make all of these things because they do have commitments. They do have to have a second job or a part-time job or whatever. I don't think it's particularly constructive.
So how would you... Go on.
No, it's
on you. So how would you suggest to encourage parents to attend more things that their children do? Because it has been, I don't know if it's been proved, but a lot of studies have been done into whether parental encouragement helps a child advance. And often it is a good thing if the parent is involved with the child's learning. Do you think, you know, how would you encourage parents to be more involved?
Thing is, that's true, and it's if a parent is able to be really involved in the child's learning, that's fantastic, and of course we should be encouraging that, because there are studies that prove that the input from a parent like that is a good input for the future for the child's learning. But it's sort of, if they can't make it because they have X amount of commitments, a job or a full-time job or two jobs or whatever, then it's a matter of finding that time, and I think it's more it makes the whole thing a lot more complicated than them saying, oh well, we'll move it to this time, or we'll try and make it more accessible to parents who work longer. I think interaction with their child, participation in the child's learning should go beyond school plays. It should be in terms of talking about homework and talking about things they learn at school.
That's what I mean, like that kind of thing.
I think if they can't make school plays because they do have a lot of commitments, they do have to work, then I think that's kind of the stumbling block that we'd have to get over, and there's no real easy solution to that.
I think this kind of looks like a little bit of like a way to which might cause some more divisions. I mean, I'm not entirely sure the prevalence of this in the UK, but I do see a lot of stories online and stuff about so-called helicopter parents who are too attentive to their children to the extent where they demand things from the teachers.
Yes.
And maybe they go too far the other way. Maybe this would kind of encourage them a little bit more, but at the same time, maybe it would reinforce the relationship which teachers need to have with the pupils, but also with the parents. Maybe it would reinforce the idea that parents are as equally engaged as students are, and teachers are still in kind of an assessing role.
In an odd way, I guess if you did get a D as a parent, it would encourage you, in a way, in rage probably, to go have a conversation with the teacher, and that might evoke communication between the two of you. Which may not have been there before. So maybe in that sense, this scheme perhaps kind of encourages communication with the parent and the teacher. I don't know what you guys think about that.
I don't think there's an issue at all, really. I think
there's an issue between communication between parents and teachers?
No, I do. I don't think this scheme will have an issue. Oh. I think, negative on it at the very least. I think it's going to be quite inconsequential. It will force discussion because it's actually it's increasing an element of communication between the parents and the teachers, which wasn't there before.
Exactly.
And that communication, as you say, can be used for other methods, unlike actually talking about the pupils' discussion and education and advancement. And if a parent or two gets offended because they get a negative mark, well, then they've got offended, and hopefully they improve the way they go about supporting their children. Maybe it will lead to some confrontation, maybe it will lead to a worsening of a couple of parent-teacher
relationships,
thank you. But on the other end of the scale, in the middle, that's probably extreme examples. The middle is probably just normal, just increases dialogue.
So Becky, what do you think of that, seeing as you said one of your parents couldn't attend things?
Well, I don't think it's going to really improve the relationship at all, because the parents are going to end up getting frustrated that they're getting a bad grade, for want of a better term, where they physically can't be there. I feel like it's kind of the teachers judging the parents, and I don't really think they have the right to do that in this case.
I mean, what was actually kind of going against my point, my parents never really came to anything I did. I didn't actually do too much, though. I wasn't particularly active in secondary school or primary school or anything. That's probably primary school, isn't it? Wasn't really active in primary school. My parents came to the things they probably should have come to, like PTA stuff, but it wasn't like they had a constant ongoing dialogue with my parents, or with my teachers, at least that I knew of. Maybe they did.
Do you think if your parents were more involved, you'd have got more involved in things, though?
Probably not. I mean, because I can't really say. If this is primary school, then I've got no idea how I would have reacted to such a long time ago. I feel like I'm okay now. So my parents probably did a good job.
No, it's just because my dad is quite involved with my brother's education at the moment, and he's just finished primary school, and my dad was actively encouraging him to take part in things. Now, I don't know whether being so involved with the school would cause your child to become more of a member of the school than just, your average, or it could have the opposite effect and push them away a little bit.
My mum was a dinner lady at my school, and it didn't really have much effect.
Did it not?
No. It's just a bit embarrassing. She used to steal my food.
Oh,
that's the real story here.
Yeah.
Oh, I think that's all we've got time for on that story. I'm going to end on the dinner lady comment. And we've got a bit of Wizard now coming up. I wish it could be Christmas every day. Are you ready, children? Yeah!
Hi, I'm Lillian Greenwood. I'm the Labour MP for Nottingham South, and you're listening to URN.
That was I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day. And now it's time for Becky, who has a story about iPhones setting on fire.
Yes, thank you. So it seems that Samsung, it's not only Samsung who are having problems with exploding phones recently. Apple have had loads of complaints about the iPhone 6 series handsets, which has started spontaneously combusting or exploding. These complaints all appear to have originated in China, with spokesmen saying there's yet no way of knowing if there's a risk of any more handsets spontaneously combusting, but have claimed that there doesn't seem to be any major implications yet for the iPhones sold outside of China. Apple have defended the claims that they dealt with faulty products slowly, stating that they treat all safety concerns with top priority and that they have found no concern with these products. However, one woman would dispute this when her phone actually exploded in her hands. Nevertheless, it may result in less sales for Apple, who in the last three quarters Chinese sales have fallen. In the aftermath of the Samsung phones exploding, many consumers have switched from Samsung to Apple, whose products have also started spontaneously combusting, so clearly there's a problem here. Do we think that more stringent security measures need to be taken to stop these phones from becoming a safety risk?
I am quite scared now because my iPhone 6 is currently in my pocket and I'm just being slightly warm.
Let's hope it doesn't burst on fire on air, hey?
Fingers crossed. We've now got the two main competitors in the smartphone market, both having phones that are spontaneously combusting. We would have thought that there were stringent enough tests that would be able to test the limits of the battery and limit any sort of chemicals or any sort of manufacturing that enables them to reach the potential to explode. So if there's something that's plaguing not just Samsung as well as Apple, then there needs to be something done by the industry as a whole to really make sure that the correct materials are being used, that the correct materials in batteries are being used, so that we don't have a repeat of what happened with the Samsung Note 7 series, where they all seem to just catch fire.
What do you think about Apple saying it's not a safety concern? But, I mean, only 8 have spontaneously combusted so far, but do we think that they need to do more about this,
yeah,
or are they just being dismissive?
8's more than it should be,
yeah,
of spontaneously combusting. I think they should see it as a safety issue and they shouldn't publicly say it's not, because that's just going to get people turning around and saying, excuse me, why is it not? Like, it makes you start worrying about Apple products and that they're not concerned for public safety. And personally, I think they should be looking into why this has happened. And, you know, maybe publishing reasons for each individual case to prove that it's not their individual model but the individual phone, saying that they're outliers or something, to stop public concern.
I mean, yeah, 8 phones might just be indicative of a bad batch.
Exactly.
And when you consider
that, they need to prove that.
Absolutely. But when you consider the number of phones which these companies do put out, then I think 8 might be, it's definitely the start of something, and as you say, they definitely should minimise public concern by giving a report or something on why this happened, and maybe we'll see that in the coming days. It's kind of like once bitten, twice shy. We've already been hurt by the Note 7, where they recalled 2.5 million Note 7 handsets. That's a large number, and if you were an Apple executive, you probably wouldn't want to do the same thing based on 8. But again, because it is such a big issue and because we all have phones right next to our faces, I think that this definitely can have the potential of evolving into a much more serious problem.
I mean, what scares me is that it was the iPhone 6 series that had phones that exploded, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, so like, because that's my one. And also, not in a more selfless way, I guess.
I think I've got an iPhone 6 as well, actually.
Yeah, it's scary, but like, If they're only starting to explode now, that's 2 years for some people. 2 years into somebody having the handset, so it worries me that there might be problems with the batteries that weren't picked up when they were originally tested, just because they hadn't been used for 2 years continuously.
I'm not sure if it was said, but I think the idea is that it was the excuse, at least, is that it was due to external damage, which might have been consistent with, like, across those 8 different cases. And if that's the case, then maybe more fail-safe should be worked in, but I'm not entirely sure what a manufacturer can do too much if it's actual damage which has caused it to explode. If you muck about with something enough, it's going to go wrong, and perhaps sometimes dangerously. I feel like that's controversial.
I mean, this is going to be an interesting point. But if you get... For example, you know, back in the day when we all had Nokia phones, they were indestructible, right? People used to flush them down toilets, throw them against walls, and they wouldn't break. Why have we gone from this brick of a phone that is indestructible to such a flimsy phone that if there is damage, it sets on fire?
I think it's because of all the
Because extra... of the apps? Yeah, but yeah. Don't you think that we should make the phone more sturdy in
and
that
my,
case?
My Nokia went through a washing machine and still worked afterwards.
Wow.
So I'm all for this.
I think, I mean, you've got to compare the two, though. I mean, looking at my iPhone right now, mine's an iPhone 5, so I'm safe. But I'm looking at mine now, and it's got a massive touchscreen, it's got massive computational power, much better than any of these Nokias that I had. It's thinner, it's far more functionality. And the Nokia, yes, may have been super rugged, may have been absolutely made of plastic and could withstand anything. Actually, with the water issue, a lot of these new phones are actually water resistant now. So they will maybe go through a washing machine, but they'll resist some level of water. But there's definitely a trade-off between functionality and being able to survive undue physical torture, essentially. You could get a massive iPhone, which is completely armored up and everything, it's padding all kinds of protective gear, but that's not very consumer friendly, and that's the issue for us consumers who lead a pretty normal and unadventurous life, unless I'm being too presumptuous there.
I don't know, my life's pretty adventurous.
Well, I mean, I'm normal and all I do is go to lectures, and I don't need a Kevlar phone to do that.
I think people are too concerned with image now as well in terms of the phone. You're frowning at me.
Well, because it sounds like you're 80 years old. You young people are so concerned.
No,
I agree
with you.
I would buy a phone if it looked hideous. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I wouldn't.
Part of it's all about the art, isn't it? It's the elegance.
So for them to build a sturdy phone, they'd have to make it look in a certain way for it to be aesthetically pleasing.
So
I'm going against my own point and saying that I think it would be harder for them to build a Nokia-type indestructible thing because it wouldn't be aesthetically pleasing.
I mean, maybe we're just now reaching the cutoff point between, we've got this balancing act between style and elegance
and safety.
Functionality. Yeah, and safety. And end of the day, that is the way capitalism goes. You keep trying to cut corners and do that unless regulations stop you, unless you come across an issue. Clearly, the regulations weren't enough in the case of the Samsung, and maybe in the case of the iPhone. And maybe now we're reaching the end of the tether, and we'll experience kind of a spring back. Maybe things will start getting more sturdy, more rigid, and we won't have these issues in the future, because this can be quite scary. And I think, I can't remember the exact financial damage that happened to Samsung, but it must have been an incredible amount. So Apple, I'm sure, are quite worried about...
They don't sound very worried.
Well,
saying
I mean,
it's not a public safety concern.
Maybe that's to assure stock markets and shareholders and all of that.
Perhaps. I think we should move on to our next story now from Emma. A bit of a lighter one, and ties in with our little Christmas theme today.
Yes, Emma? Thank you. So with Christmas just around the corner and festive cheer spreading rapidly, however, for many, Christmas can also be very, very stressful. And today the Huffington Post has run an article on the worst parts of Christmas based on what 11 people on Reddit have said they simply cannot stand about Christmas. So the first person said they cannot stand the waste from Christmas, especially the rubbishy gifts that are thrown away straight after getting them or returned for a refund. Next up is the often awful weather, followed by the pressure of the Christmas season. That's the pressure to buy expensive presents, the pressure to be surrounded by family, and the pressure to appear merry and festive all of the time. Cooking, it seems, is also a great cause of stress for many, especially for this Reddit user who is a chef and claims he's always unfairly roped into doing the cooking on Christmas Day. And on a similar note is the politics and the political arguments that normally end up occurring at the dinner table. Another user then points out the stress of not being able to afford presents for everybody who they want to buy for, whilst another rather depressingly notes the annual realisation that everyone is growing up and eventually, instead of your parents hosting the family Christmas, it's going to be you doing it. On a similar sad note, another Reddit user points out the inevitable memories of lost loved ones at Christmas, which come back to haunt her every year. On a slightly lighter note, however, this user dislikes the people who work in retail, who she claims seems to be in much higher frequency at Christmas every year, annoying her during her Christmas shopping. And this is followed by the somewhat cheesy and rather repetitive Christmas songs we hear every year that annoy many. And finally, the final Reddit user's least favourite part of Christmas is just how abruptly Christmas comes and goes and how bare the house looks when all the decorations are taken down at the end of the Christmas season. So what I want to know from you is what all your least favourite parts of Christmas are.
I mean, I'm with the last one. I absolutely love Christmas. So for when we take the decorations down in the house, it makes me feel so empty inside. Because it's over so quickly, and then that's it for another year, and you can't be happy for a long time until New Year, and then it gets festive again. But it's just, it is a horrible moment, Boxing Day, when you have to start putting things in boxes and putting them away.
You take your decorations down on Boxing
no,
Day?
No, I don't take that's the decorations down. Let's clarify this. I don't take the decorations down on Boxing Day, but we start putting presents away on Boxing Day, and that's the start of it.
I would admit to not necessarily being a massive Christmas fan as I grew up. I was kind of like, oh, I don't like you guys, kind of teenager. Very antisocial towards my family, for better or for worse. But recently, kind of experienced a renaissance. My sister's got very much into it, and she's kind of roped me into it. And I appreciate, especially after being supported by my family for the last bloody 3 years, I appreciate what they do for me so much more nowadays. And I really appreciate the time to actually have some family bonding, especially because, you know, I've been away for months now at this point. I've only seen my mum once this entire term. And I know I slagged her off earlier. but mum, if you're listening, which you won't be, I love you. I would let's have a good Christmas.
Christmas spirit.
So I do appreciate the family time.
Oh, I love my parents to pieces, just like you said, but my dad is such a Scrooge. Seriously, he hates Christmas cards. I've had to stop wrapping his presents in newspaper because he dislikes Christmas wrapping. And one, he actually hates some of my family so much, he had a barbecue outside so he could be outside while everybody else was inside. So he's hell to live with at Christmas. He absolutely hates it. He only cheers up after New Year.
Lewis, what's your worst thing about Christmas?
Yeah, it's when it all ends. I love Christmas. Too.
You're sat there with your Christmas jumper
on right
now.
With my Christmas jumper on. When I can't wear this anymore in January, I will cry. I really love the lights and winter. I only like the December bit of winter because it's Christmassy, because even though it's so cold outside, everyone seemingly seems to be happier. They see that everybody's a little bit more cheery. They want to speak to people. They want to spend time with people they care about. And then in January, it all goes all dark and horrible. Yeah. And that's the realization that it's another year until all this happens again, and you've got 2 months of winter.
Yeah.
It's disgusting.
It's sad. I have to say, I think my least favourite part of Christmas is the time that we get served the Christmas lunch, because it normally ends up at about 5 p.m. so you spend most of the day being hungry or just eating loads of chocolate.
I was about to say, I eat all the chocolate first.
So
And also just generally, not that I really do much of it, but the cooking of the Christmas dinner seems to be quite stressful. Seems to be about like 12 relatives all in the kitchen at the same time. And for what's meant to be like a very happy, cheery day, it normally turns into quite a stressful one, I think. But I do love it. I love Christmas.
I think the most stressful part is keeping the relatives you don't know very well entertained.
Yes.
In the living room when everyone else is cooking. I think that's quite stressful. You have to think of topics.
When they ask you about adulthood and about your future,
how
just
are
like,
you doing?
Well.
How's the degree?
I'm going to get so much of that, Lewis. Final year, so we're going to get told, asked all
Indeed.
These questions.
Same.
I think that's all we've got to say on the worst parts of Christmas. Thank you so much, Stefan, Lewis, Becky and Emma, for joining me today on The Pulse. Next is the Big Picture, Lewis.
Big Picture, I'm hosting, listen in, please.
Yeah, Lewis is going to continue on air. And to finish off The Pulse tonight, we have Santa Baby by Eartha Kitt. If you'd like to listen to The Pulse again, it's on again tomorrow, 5 till 6, with similar news stories and debate. But that's it for now. Enjoy Santa Baby.
This is URN The Pulse. Boom, 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 boom,
sable under the tree for me. Been an awful good girl, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Santa baby, a 54 convertible to light blue. I'll wait up for you, dear Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Think of all